At Public.com, you can earn 5.1% APY with a high-yield cash account. And while we can't say it's officially the highest interest rate out there, we can say this. It's higher than Robinhood, SoFi, Wealthfront, Capital One, and the big banks, too. Ready to start earning 5.1% APY on your cash? Check out the high-yield cash account on Public.com. This is paid for by Public Investing. 5.1% APY as of March 26, 2024, and is subject to change. A high-yield cash account is a secondary brokerage account with Public Investing, member FINRA/SIPC. Funds from this account are automatically deposited into partner banks where they earn a variable interest and are eligible for FDIC insurance. Neither Public Investing nor any of its affiliates is a bank. U.S. only. Learn more at public.com/disclosure/high-yield-account.
This Marketplace podcast is supported by Invest Puerto Rico. What's next in innovation? That's not the right question. It's where. Puerto Rico, more than just a tropical paradise, it's innovation's paradise, where startups and global players coexist in a vast and vibrant ecosystem, where talent runs deep, highly skilled, and bilingual. Plus, the island offers the most competitive tax incentives in the U.S. If you believe your business can go anywhere, Puerto Rico is the place. Find out more at investpr.org/marketplace. Again, that address is investpr.org/marketplace.
On the program today, the house behind a very, very famous painting. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdal. It is Thursday today. This one is the 2nd of February. Good as always to have you along, everybody. A data point or two, actually three data points as we begin today. Points one and two, though, are of a piece. Updates from the Bank of England and the European Central Bank on their interest rate inclinations. Both of them bumped their benchmark rates half a percentage point today, continuing the global central bank hike-a-palooza after the Fed yesterday. The European Central Bank's right in line with Jay Powell and the Fed. They are promising to stay the course until inflation is completely dead, not just mostly dead. The Bank of England, not quite as steadfast, hinting today it might take a pause depending on how the economy over there goes. The economy over here, for all the talk of trouble ahead, and there is plenty, it continues really to look not so bad, the labor market in particular. Data point number three today is the weekly report on first-time claims for unemployment that we get every Thursday, down again to 183,000 people applying for jobless benefits for the first time. That is a nine-month low. Related, in a way, is this item. For the first time since the before times, average office occupancy rates in 10 major cities have hit 50% of where they used to be. That's from Castle Systems. They track people swiping their key cards in and out of big office buildings. The question, of course, is what is one to make of that, that we are now halfway back to where we were 3 years ago? Marketplace's Samantha Fields has that one.
Most places you go these days feel just as crowded as they did before COVID.
People have returned to virtually every place they come together at levels comparable to pre-pandemic levels, whether it's restaurants or planes or sporting events.
Mark Ein at Castle Systems says the big exception is the office.
Up until a few months ago, a very tight labor market and a strong economy basically prevented companies from either making mandates or enforcing mandates, despite a desire to get people back.
But he says since September or so, as uncertainty and fear about the economy have risen, so has the number of people going back into big office buildings in major cities like New York and LA. Some of that is employers requiring it, but Kate Lister at Global Workplace Analytics says some is also people choosing to go in more.
There's the concern that if you're not in the office, you're going to be passed over for promotions and raises and the best projects. And so as layoffs start to come, you start to think about, well, you know, maybe I should be in the office.
But even though the numbers have ticked up a bit in those big cities, they're still low. And in most of the rest of the country,
the number of days work from home is slightly ticking down, but it's incredibly stable.
Nicholas Bloom is an economics professor at Stanford.
Folks in big, shiny skyscrapers in big cities think banks, think tech are returning to the office, but the typical American you know, is basically working at home as much as they were 3 months ago, as much as they were, in fact, 6 months ago.
And he says it's likely to remain that way for a while. If this is the new normal and big city offices are never going to be as full as they once were, Bloom says that could be a good thing for downtowns.
Because office occupancy is so much lower, many offices are being converted into apartments.
And eventually, he says, that should push rents down and make it possible for some people who've been priced out of cities to move back. I'm Samantha Fields for Marketplace.
On Wall Street today, we got some down, we got some up, and we got some way up. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. It turns out that Subway, once upon a time the home of the $5 footlong and, by my admittedly unscientific count, the sponsor of every other commercial on television, that company did pretty well last year. The sandwich chain said today same-store sales were up 9.2% in 2022. And we mention that because inflation is putting the fast food industry in kind of a weird spot. Chains are facing rising costs for labor and for ingredients, which obliges them to raise their prices. At the same time, though, inflation puts consumers in the mood for value meals, even if value is kind of a relative term nowadays. Marketplace's Matt Levin has this one.
Jonathan Cox is a creature of habit. Twice a week, around 11:30, he drives from his office in Oklahoma City to get his favorite fast food lunch.
This is going to sound terrible. It's literally a nachos Bel Grande and generally two bean burritos. And I chose those options because generally they're on the cheaper side of the menu.
As recently as 2021, that Taco Bell meal cost Cox about $8, a fair price for any twinge of shame he may have felt. But now that meal is about $11, no drink included.
That's what they want me to pay for it. And, well, I want what they're offering me, so I just go on about my day.
Prices have gone up across lots of fast food outlets, but so far that hasn't really slowed demand, says Ben Coley at QSR Magazine, which tracks the industry.
I think what's primarily helping with that is how other things have kind of, you know, lifted off.
Groceries have also gotten more expensive, and so have traditional restaurants. Coley says while inflation has caused lower-income consumers to scale back on fast food, it's actually helped fast food restaurants attract richer customers.
They're trading down. They're trading down from the casual dining places. They're trading down from the fine dining places.
Well, that's helped. It's by no means boom times for fast food, says analyst Sean Dunlop at Morningstar.
We've had a lot of operators navigating 20% plus inflation and input costs. You know, operators have actually seen their margins contract quite a bit over the last 12 to 18 months.
Fast food chains also need to be careful not to raise prices to the point where customers just don't think it's worth it anymore. Jonathan Cox, the Taco Bell loyalist, he says his red line is $15 for his nachos and bean burritos. Again, not including a drink. I'm Matt Levin for Marketplace.
Staying in the world of food here for a bit, basically the opposite of the Subways of the world, really, there is something happening at certain kinds of local independent stores and coffee shops. Fancy pantries, if you will, all of them selling the same basic things. Emily Sundberg's a writer in Brooklyn who wrote about it for New York Magazine's Grub Street. Emily, thanks for coming on the program.
Happy to be here.
Tell me how this piece came to be, would you?
Sure. So I've worked in multiple different business settings over the past few years, and I started noticing this same retail setup kind of copy and pasted, whether it was in a wine store or a coffee shop or a bookstore. And it was the same three or four brands that I was used to seeing pretty much constantly on Instagram over the past few years. And I started to investigate why these same four or five brands were everywhere.
But before we get to the sort of the payout of what your research told you, what were the brands? Were they the same products, or was it, what were you seeing like literally on the shelves?
Yeah, I was observing mostly food brands. So there was Graza olive oil, which I wrote about. There's a tinned fish brand called Fishwife. They're all pantry basics that we've seen our whole life. Nothing's new, nothing's invented, but it's just the packaging is sexier, and they all have these really big founder stories that have been heavily marketed over the past few years.
You mentioned this, and I just want to pick up on this. This sounds very Instagram friendly, millennial-y, sort of going to that demographic. Is that
yeah,
fair?
Most of these brands started as direct-to-consumer, Instagram-focused brands that exploded over the pandemic because the pendulum had shifted heavily to home cooking and people really embracing their kitchens. So it was like a really hot market for founders and investors.
Yeah, well, so now let me get to the gears behind this, because you also talk about, I guess it's an online marketplace called Faire, F-A-I-R-E. And I want you to, number one, explain what it is, and number two, explain how it applies to these sort of brands and goods showing up in these boutique coffee shops in Brooklyn.
So Faire is a wholesale marketplace. So traditionally, if you were a store and you wanted to fill your store with interesting brands, you'd spend money to go to a trade show, meet vendors, form relationships with them, and a few months later get their stuff in your store. But Faire, which was started a few years ago, it's now considered a decacorn. I think they were recently valued at something like $12 billion, is essentially like the Amazon of wholesale. So you can just go on as a store, find these hot brands that you see online and place a bulk order for them. And they carry brands of all different sizes. So maybe you're a coffee shop that wants to carry the same stuff that Whole Foods has, but you don't need to have a direct relationship with that brand anymore. You can just go on Faire and have it done extremely quickly and efficiently. And yeah, that was sort of like the Oz behind the curtain of how all of these brands are having the same retail setup.
And that's great, right? Because you want small businesses to have the same opportunity to get products as Whole Foods, but it does kind of give lie to the whole, oh, this is just a tiny little sort of boutique-y thing going on here.
Yeah, and I think most people, if they spend the time to look into the brands that they're purchasing from, most of these fundraising records are public. And again, I'm not bashing fundraising. Mm-hmm. I just think that putting your product next to actual small businesses can be a little bit confusing for the consumer. And then the other side of this is just the rise of this new general store and how all specialty stores look the same now. So none of them are actually really that special.
Fair enough. Emily Sundberg, she wrote in New York Magazine about these things that are like little tiny shops that kind of maybe aren't. Emily, thanks a lot. I appreciate your time.
Sure thing. Have a good one.
There is, in Article 1 of the Constitution of the United States, a discussion of a kind of agreement known as an interstate compact, agreements between states. Maybe the best known? Driver's licenses. You get a license in one state, you can use it in the other 49, and, yes, the District of Columbia. Of late, there have been interstate compacts around specific professions, too, including teaching. At least 10 states are considering joining an interstate compact that would make it easier for teachers licensed in one state to work in another. Marketplace's Stephanie Hughes reports.
Superintendent Mark Laurie leads the Niagara Falls School District in Western New York, and he would love to do more hiring of experienced teachers from out of state. But
there are people who say, you know what? I don't want to go through the whole process of having to see what I have to do in New York State. Do I have to pay another fee? Do I have to take another test?
This new teacher compact would let teachers in states that join get certified more easily in other states that join. People moving between participating states wouldn't have to dig up 20-year-old transcripts or pay hundreds of dollars in fees to be eligible for teaching jobs. Adam Deersing is a policy analyst with the Council of State Governments, which works with states to develop these agreements.
One of the things that's true across all interstate compacts is they require some degree of trust. A good teacher in Missouri is also going to be a good teacher in Washington.
This compact was proposed by the Department of Defense because people in the military move a lot and their spouses can have a hard time landing teaching jobs in new places. But it could have implications for all teachers. Chad Alderman is the policy director at the Edunomics Lab at Georgetown.
Teachers are far less likely to move across state lines than other professions. And it's tied to these licensure rules.
This would be the first interstate occupational license compact not related to healthcare. Previous ones have allowed nurses to move freely between dozens of states. And Adam Deersing at the Council of State Governments says this one could help meet demand for educators.
You know, we do think that there's a set of the teaching population that we're losing every year pretty much across the country because of these barriers.
And schools, especially those on state borders, are missing out on talent because they can't always easily hire people who live in the vicinity. I'm Stephanie Hughes for Marketplace.
Coming up.
It's a little bitty house. It's not a castle.
It is, though, the background of the most famous pitchfork painting in America. First, though, let's do the numbers. Dow Industrial's down 39 points today. 10% closed at 34,053. The NASDAQ, 384 points to the good, 3.25%. Finished at 12,200. The S&P 500 advanced 60 points, nearly 1.5%. 41.79. Meta galloped ahead 23% today. Its best day in a very, very, very long time. The Facebook parent company reported revenue after the bell yesterday that exceeded expectations. It got some analyst upgrades as well. And what seems to really please investors was Mark Zuckerberg's statement that 2023 is going to be the year of efficiency for the company. Wall Streeters dig efficiency, as you know. Seems relevant here to point out that Meta stock price dropped, you know, like 64% last year. Shell just posted its biggest ever annual profit, $39.9 billion for the past year, more than double its 2021 profit. On the London Stock Exchange today, Shell, because capitalism, subtracted 1%. You're listening to Marketplace.
Looking for the highest interest rate on your cash? At public.com, you can earn 5.1% APY with a high-yield cash account. And while we can't say it's officially the highest interest rate out there, we can say this. It's a higher rate than Robinhood, a higher rate than SoFi, a higher rate than Marcus, a higher rate than Wealthfront, frankly, a higher rate than Capital One, a higher rate than Ally, a higher rate than Barclays, a way higher rate than Bank of America and Chase, a higher rate than Citi, Wells Fargo, Discover, and it's a higher rate than American Express, too. So if you want to start earning 5.1% APY on your cash, check out public.com. We can't say it's the highest interest rate, but it's pretty darn up there. This is paid for by Public Investing. 5.1% APY as of March 26, 2024, and is subject to change. A high-yield cash account is a secondary brokerage account with Public Investing, member FINRA/SIPC. Funds from this account are automatically deposited into partner banks where they earn a variable interest and are eligible for FDIC insurance. Neither Public Investing nor any of its affiliates is a bank. U.S. only. Learn more at public.com/disclosure/high-yield-account.
This Marketplace podcast is supported by Gusto. Let your employees know you've got their back by signing up for Gusto for payroll and HR. More than 300,000 small business owners use Gusto. They offer benefits like health insurance, employee onboarding, and more. Get your payroll taxes filed, deductions calculated, and your team paid fast. No more pain. Just the joy of running your business. Get 3 months free when you go to gusto.com/marketplace. That's gusto.com/marketplace.
Behind every successful business is a story, and some of them might surprise you. Like how Chobani's first yogurt factory was discovered on a piece of junk mail. Or how the founder of the multi-million dollar cosmetics brand Drunk Elephant was told by everyone, including her own mother, that the name sounded like a dive bar. On the podcast How I Built This, host Guy Raz talks to founders behind the world's biggest companies to learn how they built them. In each episode, you'll hear entrepreneurs share moments of doubt, failure, and how they were able to overcome setbacks on their way to the top. How I Built This is like a masterclass in innovation and creativity, a how-to guide for navigating life's challenges from the people who've done it all. Follow How I Built This wherever you get your podcasts. Listen early and ad-free right now on Wondery Plus. For more business content like this, listen on Wondery, the destination for business podcasts. With shows like How I Built This, Business Wars, and many more, Wondery means business.
This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. Mortgage rates dropped again this week. Freddie Mac, the government home loan conglomerate, said the 30-year fixed is at just a hair over 6%, close to a full percentage point, lower than we were seeing back in November. And as those rates have fallen, there's been a decided shift in the housing market. After months of falling sales and falling prices in parts of the country, sales are picking back up again. Yes, some of that is seasonal, and some of it's obviously just math. Lower interest rates and lower prices make buying a little bit more affordable. But as Marketplace's Amy Scott reports, there might be some psychology going on here, too.
When Emily and Jake Cheek started house shopping in Portland, Oregon last June, interest rates for a 30-year mortgage averaged around 5%. In late August, they made an offer on a 3-bedroom ranch house with a big backyard, got outbid, and took a couple weeks off for vacation.
And when we got back, our realtor sent us an email and was like, hey, so things are different.
Different bad. Interest rates had shot up to about 6%, and before long, 7%.
And it really did change the monthly payment.
By several hundred dollars. The Cheeks kept looking, but their broker, Brad Twiss of Neighbors Realty, says the market kind of ground to a halt.
We did 33 transactions last year, and I don't think we wrote a single offer in October. You know, almost all of October rates were over 7%.
But in the last couple months, things have changed again. In December, interest rates fell back to around 6%, and Twiss says sales started picking up. He remembers a turning point in early January when this one house went on the market.
And it got multiple offers.
Even though it was on a very busy street.
You know, it was a cute house, but like, that's a huge objection for a lot of people. And then every weekend since has basically been multiple offers.
Now, that's just one broker's view in one city. But the shift is showing up in the national numbers, too. In December, the number of houses under contract rose for the first time in 7 months. That's according to the National Association of Realtors. The brokerage Redfin says it's seeing more applications for mortgages and requests for home tours. Redfin's chief economist Daryl Fairweather says, for one thing, prices have receded from their peak last spring.
And because the market's recalibrated and kind of gotten used to these higher interest rates, buyers are starting to come back.
I've seen this idea a lot lately, that buyers have acclimated to higher rates.
Just the fact that they've come down from their peak helps with the psychology of buyers to make them feel like they aren't getting a really raw deal. They're getting, you know, a fine deal right now.
Research in behavioral economics backs this up. Ravi Dhar directs Yale's Center for Customer Insights.
People assess rates or prices not in terms of absolute levels, as economists would say, but relative to a reference point.
Historically speaking, Dhar says 6% is a pretty low mortgage rate, as anyone who bought a house in the 80s and 90s will tell you. But for the past decade, that reference point has been around 4%, and the past couple of years, around 3%.
So when interest rates went up to 7%, so you got a shock. Is 7% too high? Actually, it may not be too high in the absolute sense, but it is a lot higher than 4%.
After a while, though, people adapt to a higher reference point. So when rates dropped back down to 6...
Now the reference point is not 4 anymore, it's 7. So compared to 7, 6 looks pretty good, right?
Dhar says that may be driving some buyers back to the market. But ultimately, it comes down to what people can afford. And in Portland, what Emily and Jake Cheek can afford has changed.
We're originally looking for, like, you know, the classic 3-bedroom, 2-bath situation. And now it's looking more like maybe a 3-bedroom, 1-bath or a 2-bedroom with an unfinished basement.
The Cheeks are resigned to rates being higher than when they started looking. Maybe they can refinance in the future. Still,
when the rates drop a little bit, it's super exciting. We're like, oh, great. Like, it's more fun to look then.
Then again, interest rates only matter if you need a mortgage. The last house they put an offer on, they lost out to someone paying cash. I'm Amy Scott for Marketplace.
We've been doing a series for a couple of years now called Adventures in Housing. And most of the time, they're stories about one person or one family finding a place to call home. Today, though, the story of one house instead of the people in it. This one's a little white farmhouse. It's got a big Gothic window sitting on a grassy lawn in Eldon, Iowa, made famous by the 1930 Grant Wood painting American Gothic. You've seen it, I'm sure, the farmer holding a pitchfork standing next to his daughter. It's been parodied on T-shirts and magazine covers, cereal boxes, and plenty more. Often overlooked, though, is the house itself.
My name is Carrie Nicely, and I am the administrator of the American Gothic House Center. The house was built between, I believe it was 1881-ish, by Charles Dibble and his wife. And it had two rooms on the main floor. It had two rooms upstairs. Then they lost the house because they didn't pay the property taxes. So move on to the next owner. About the 1930s, we're at the beginning of the Great Depression. Grant Wood was invited to an art, I'll say kind of an art expo, an art show, and came across this house, and it was kind of like Grant Wood said, stop, look at that little house with that big pretentious window. And he started formulating the idea for American Gothic right then and there. It just was part of that sketch that he created in front of what is known as the Dibble House. It was put on the National Register of Historic Places in 1974, but I mean, it's just a house, you know, to people, you know, and they lived there and they moved in. There still was someone living in there up until 2014. It has a deep meaning to the community. Economically, it also is important because people come here just to see that house. It's a little bitty house. It's not a castle. That guy that's in that picture, you could see him up the street in the store. He's not a king. She's not a queen. And that pitchfork represents, especially here in Iowa, is food. People that live here in Iowa, we know where our food comes from. It's representing things that are real at a time where things were so difficult. I know that I have had people where they come and they say, and even, you know, they give reviews where, oh, it's just a little house, it's just a window. But I'm hoping that we get people to reach beyond that and understand it's more than just that little house. It is the hope that people held on to during the Great Depression, and that is held true from the 30s clear till, you know, almost 100 years later.
Carrie Nicely, she is the administrator of the American Gothic House Center there in Eldon, Iowa. You can tell us about a remarkable house you know of or about your own adventure in housing. You can do it at marketplace.org. Final note on the way out. Kristen Schaub was telling us yesterday about the woes betiding Bed Bath & Beyond as it tries to stay out of bankruptcy protection. Axios reports today that the company missed $1 billion or so in bond payments yesterday. It is not the end for BBBY. There is a 30-day grace period for those payments, but a good thing it is not. All right, we are going, not though without your moment of economic context, really more of a confession, I think. I kind of feel like we haven't really reminded y'all of this enough this week, what with the Fed meeting and all. The January unemployment report comes out tomorrow. Here is my favorite and IMHO underreported thing about it. The margin of error on the jobs report, plus or minus 120,000 on the number of jobs, plus or minus 0.2% on the rate. Remember that when you read it. I'm just saying. John Buckley, John Gordon, Rick Carr, Diantha Parker, Amanda Petra, and Stephanie Seek are the Marketplace editing staff. Amir Babawe is the managing editor. I'm Kai Rizdal. We will see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.